We try to level up, to change, to fix, to identify a problem that is any problem but the actual problem at hand. When you start showing up as exactly who you are, you start radically changing your life. You start receiving authentic love. You start doing your best and most profitable and effortless work. You start laughing. You start enjoying things again. You start realizing that you just needed anything to project all this fear onto, so you chose the most vulnerable and common issues in life. When you start showing up exactly as you are, you cut the bullshit. You declare to the world that you will not only love yourself when it sees you as worthy. You will not only have values when you have everything you could ever need. You will not only be principled once you get where you want to be. You will not only be happy once someone loves you. When you show up as you are, you disrupt this pattern. The goodness of life is no longer reserved for some version of you that you'll probably never be. This was always a game for you to explain to yourself why it is you didn't feel good naturally, before you knew how to start showing up and allowing your feelings. When you still lived in the darkness, you had to suppress that and project it onto other issues. No longer. You are showing up as you are today and taking what's yours. Not what belongs to some imaginary version of yourself. Not what you think the world thinks you're worthy of. You, here, now. That is the true healing. In fact, the universe does not allow perfection. Without breaks and gaps, there would be no growth. Nature depends on imperfection. Fault lines make mountains. Star implosions become supernovas. And the death of one season creates the rebirth of the next. You are not here to live up to the exact expectation that you've mustered up in your head. You are not here to do everything precisely right and precisely on time. To do so would require stripping your life of spontaneity, curiosity, and awe. What leaves the path is clearing the path. There is nothing that you can do to win someone or something that is not meant to be yours. You can fight with everything you have. You can hold on for as long as you can. You can force yourself into mental gymnastics to pick apart signs. You can have your friends read into texts and emails. You can decide that you know what's best for you and right for you. Mostly, you can wait. You can wait forever. What isn't right for you will never remain in your life. There is no job, person, or city that you can force to be right for you if it is not, though you can pretend for a while. You can play games with yourself. You can justify and make ultimatums. You can say you'll try just a little longer, and you can make excuses for why things aren't working out right now. The truth is that what is right for you will come to you and stay with you, and won't err from you for long. The truth is that when something is right for you, it brings you clarity. And when something is wrong for you, it brings you confusion. You get stuck when you try to make something that's wrong for you right. When you try to force it into a place in your life in which it doesn't belong. You get split. You breed this internal conflict which you cannot resolve. The more it intensifies, the more you mistake it for passion. How could you ever feel so strongly about something that isn't right? You can, because you can use your mind to get attached. You can fall in love with potential as opposed to reality. You can orchestrate and choreograph dances of how you'll live out your days when things finally settle into their rightful place. You can hinge on a fantasy life in which everything you think you want has taken root in your everyday life. But if it isn't showing up, it's just that, a fantasy. And when we start to deeply believe in an illusion, it becomes a delusion. And a delusion can be a really compelling thing. The truth is that what is not right for you will never remain with you. Though you might want to pretend that you don't know if this is the case, you do. You can feel it. It's why you have to grip so hard and with so little give. The things that are right for you can be free from you. You don't have to convince them that they are right. You don't have to line up the evidence as though you're pleading your case. Sometimes we get lost in old dreams. We get lost in the lives others wanted us to have. We get stuck on what we thought we should be, what we assumed we would have. We get derailed by all the ideas floating around our heads about what it could be and should be if only things were different, if only everything would click. That's why life gives us this kind of insurance. Sometimes it pulls away from us what is wrong for us when we are not willing to see it for ourselves. Because the truth is that we do not want what is not right for us. We are simply attached to it. We are simply afraid. We are simply stuck in the assumption that nothing better will replace it, that its absence will open up a well of endless, infinite suffering for which there will be no solution. We do not want what is not right for us. We are just scared to let go of what we believe will make us secure. The funny part is, there is nothing that makes us more insecure than hanging around what isn't right for us. There's nothing that will collapse faster. There's nothing that will bring us inner turmoil quite like it. What is not right for you will never remain in your life, and not because there are forces beyond us navigating the minutiae of our everyday lives. What is not right for you will not remain with you, because deep down, you know it's not right. You are the one who eventually lets go, sees reality, and walks away. You are the one resisting. You are the one holding back. You are the one concocting healing fantasies about how great it will be when you force something wrong to finally be right. What is not right for you does not remain with you because you don't want it, and so you don't choose it. You step away when you are ready. You let go when you are able. And you realize, all along, that all you were really in love with was a little trick of the light that made you feel safe. Recovering from emotional trauma. You might think trauma is in your head, in the metaphorical sense. It is actually in your body, in the literal sense. Trauma is what happens when something scares you and you do not get over that fear. If you do not resolve or defeat it, you get into, and remain in, a sustained state of fight or flight, which is essentially the human panic response for survival. Trauma is the experience of disconnecting from a fundamental feeling of safety. Unless you are able to reestablish that connection, a particularly destructive bias distorts your worldview. You become hypersensitive, which means that you will ascribe intent, overthink, overreact, become triggered by innocuous stimuli, personalize neutral situations, and remain in a mental combat mode. After experiencing trauma, your brain will rewire itself temporarily to seek out the potential threat in anything, which makes it very difficult to both move on from the initial problem and then not to develop a victim complex. After all, your brain is literally trying to show you every imaginable way the world could be out to get you. This is why exposure is so effective as a treatment for fear or anxiety. By gradually reintroducing the stressor into someone's life and showing them that they are able to handle it, the brain is able to return to a neutral state because a feeling of control and security is being reestablished. This is also why people who have stronger social ties and mental resilience prior to a traumatic event are more likely to use the event as a catalyst for self-reflection, growth, compassion, and healing, as opposed to self-destruction. They had multiple ties to that essential feeling of safety, so even if one was eroded or severed, others still were there to support them. What happens to your brain after a traumatic event? Neurologically, we process stress in three parts of the brain. The first is the amygdala, The second is the hippocampus. And the third is the prefrontal cortex. Individuals suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, have a smaller hippocampus, the center of emotion and memory, increased amygdala function, the center of rumination and creativity, and decreased medial prefrontal anterior cingulate function, the center that governs complex behaviors like planning and self-development. It becomes clear then why trauma tends to have the following impact on us. Our brains stop processing memory fully, leaving us with fragments of what happened, sometimes contributing to the feeling of disassociation. Our ability to manage a range of emotions decreases. We become stifled and stuck, have trouble planning for the future, and our self-development and actualization come to a halt. When we enter a state of fight or flight, our body literally ceases any advanced function that is not necessary for our survival. The body's main receptors become extremely sensitive and reactive to stimuli. This is a beautiful and essential part of being human. It's kept us alive as a species. However, it is not a state that is meant to be sustained. Centuries ago, when we were at the lower rung of actualization, or the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, what concerned us most was physical survival. Today, our focus is primarily on self-actualization and meaningfulness and trying to feel safe through social acceptance, money, or mental acuity. With all of this gray area, it seems obvious that more people would be mentally and emotionally struggling than they did prior, despite having more physical challenges to overcome. Recovery comes down to something very simple, which is restoring the feeling of one's safety. However, the most important part of this restoration is that you must reestablish a feeling of safety in the exact area of life that traumatized you. Often, if someone is traumatized by a relationship they had when they were young, they will reinvest that energy into valuing being attractive or successful. To them, they believe that if they are good enough, they can never be denied or rejected again. However, we all know this is not how this works. It actually makes us have unhealthy and destructive attachments to these things. If we are traumatized by a relationship, we restore the feeling of safety by working on other healthy, safe relationships. If we are traumatized by money, we restore the feeling of safety by doing what we must to ensure we have enough and by saving for an emergency expense. If we are traumatized by job loss, we restore the feeling of safety by having a backup plan or a side gig in line in case it were to happen again. If we are traumatized by being bullied, we restore the feeling of safety by finding new friends. What most people try to do is overcompensate in an area of life that is not the real problem. For example, if they struggled in relationships, they hoard money to keep themselves feeling safe. Of course, this is always futile because the problem never gets solved. Your trauma is not in your head. It is literally a changed state in your brain, and the only way you will help your body to return to its actual state is by recreating the feeling of safety that allows you to turn off survival mode and return to normal life. Releasing emotional backlog. Your emotional backlog is like your email inbox. It might be a simple analogy, but it's an effective one. When you experience emotions, it's as though you're getting little messages from your body, stacking up one at a time. If you don't ever open them, you end up 1,000 plus notifications deep, totally overlooking crucial information and important insights that you need to move your life forward. At the same time, you can't sit around all day and respond to every message just as it comes up. You'd never get anything done. It is a mistake to assume that emotions are optional experiences. They are not. But we are masters of avoiding our feelings, and we do it in so many ways. Often we rely on substances that physically numb us, projections and judgments that place the attention on someone else's faults as opposed to our own, all kinds of other worldly pursuits, and on the most basic level, tensing our bodies up so efficiently that we are rendered incapable of feeling. Psychologically, you probably know that this doesn't work for long. The backlog starts to jam eventually. You are forced to sit and be still and sleep and cry and feel it all. I wish there were some poetic, mystical truth to share here, but there isn't. There is only your anatomy, the physiology of what's happening inside you when you feel. Emotions are physical experiences. We flush our bodies of everything, and regularly so. We defecate, we sweat, we cry, we literally shed our entire skin once a month. Feelings are no different. They are experiences that must likewise be released. When not felt, emotions become embodied. They become literally stuck in your body. This is because they have something called a motor component, which means that the minute they begin, before you can suppress or ignore them, they create a micromuscular activation. Our bodies respond instantaneously. We often store pain and tension in the area of the body where an expression began but was never fully materialized. This is because, neurologically speaking, the part of your brain that regulates emotions, the anterior cingulate, is next to the premotor area, which means that when a feeling is processed, it immediately begins to generate a physical, bodied response. The premotor area connects to the motor cortex and then spans back into the specific muscles that are going to express the emotion. Which muscles express which emotion? Well, it depends. We have a lot of language that clues us into where we have physical reactions to emotions. We often feel fear in our stomachs. Think of a nervous stomach or a gut instinct. And heartache in our chests. That's where the whole broken heart thing comes from. Stress and anxiety in our shoulders. Think of the weight of the world on your shoulders. And relationship problems in the neck. Think they are a pain in the neck. But it actually goes even deeper than this. Let's say that someone did something to you that crossed a boundary, and your instinct was to yell at them. However, because you understood it was not effective to literally scream, you held back. Though this may have been the right thing to do in the moment, your body may be storing residual tension in the neck or throat area. In other cases, people can experience psychosomatic effects of their emotions that are a bit more abstract, such as pain in their knees or feet when they are traumatized by moving forward in their lives, and so on. The truth is that our bodies are speaking to us in voiceless symbols. If we can learn to interpret what they are saying, we can heal ourselves in an entirely new way. So you know that emotions sometimes get stored in your body when they are not fully expressed. Be this as it is, how do we begin to flush ourselves from them? There are a number of strategies that you can use to do this, and what matters is that it's effective for you. There is no one-size-fits-all, but there are a few options that tend to work well for most people, particularly when they are used in tandem. Stop meditating to feel calm. Start meditation to just feel. I know that this goes against everything you've ever heard about meditation, but it is actually the point of meditation. If you sit down for a 10-minute session and try to force yourself to be relaxed and light, you are effectively doing the exact same type of suppression that likely gave you the need to meditate in the first place. Instead, the point of meditation is to sit idly as you experience all of those feelings come up. the rage, the fear, the sadness, the overwhelming mind chatter. And in spite of how alluring or triggering it may be, you learn to stay still and not respond to it. You learn to allow these thoughts and feelings to come up and then pass by virtue of you not reacting to them. This takes practice. Use breath scans to find residual tension in the body. It usually doesn't take too much extra effort to figure out where in your body you are storing pain. You feel it. It's in your chest, your stomach, your shoulders, whatever is bothering you. However, if you aren't sure, or if you want to zero in specifically on where that pain is, do something called a breath scan. In this, you will breathe in and out slowly, and without taking a break between breaths. When you do this, you will begin to notice that you might hit a snag or hiccup somewhere, that in the process of taking your breath, you will start to feel precisely where in your body you are storing tension. Once you know, you can start to go into that feeling more, visualizing what it is, where it came from, and what it needs you to know. Often in this scenario, we are brought back to specific memories or past versions of ourselves that need assistance or guidance. Use a journal to write down what you experience and see, and remember that the body often speaks in metaphors, so don't necessarily take everything literally. Sweat, move, cry. The last, the hardest, and the most important part of releasing your emotions is really the only thing you have to do. You have to feel them. Sometimes this means allowing yourself to feel like total shit. Sometimes this means pushing yourself through a workout, yoga, stretching, walking, or confronting triggering thoughts and letting yourself cry out what's bothering you. Remember that emotional health is not the experience of being perpetually calm and happy all of the time. It is the experience of allowing a range of emotions, both good and bad, and not getting too stuck on either one. Similarly, mental health and self-mastery is the ability to see and feel and experience a thought without responding to it. The response, or lack thereof, is where we regain our power and reclaim our lives. You were not born to be perfect. You were not born to be happy all of the time. But if you can commit each day to doing the work of being fully human and feeling, even when you are afraid, you can transcend in a way that is truly beautiful. What it really means to heal your mind. Healing your mind is not the same thing as healing your body. When you're wounded, you often go through a progressive, linear repair. You get better until one day you are nearly back to where you were before. Healing your mind is completely different because you aren't returning to what you were before. You are gutting yourself and becoming someone entirely new. If that seems a little bit violent and harsh, it should. Healing is not a lovely ascension into comfort and wellness to be experienced once and forevermore. Healing yourself is the most uncomfortable, disruptive, important thing you will ever do. Healing yourself is returning to your most natural state, which is hungry for personal freedom, irreverent to the suffocating opinions of others, creates without doubt, shows up without fear, and loves without stipulations and agreements and conditions. Who you truly are is at once the best version of yourself you might not have ever imagined and the most essential version of yourself that you have always been. And getting to that place, it requires a lot. Healing requires you to take an honest inventory of your grudges and aggressions and the wells of longing and fear you've been ignoring all this time. It requires you to take stock of precisely what is wrong with your life so you can work to make it right. It requires you to be completely honest about how you really feel, and then it requires you to actually feel it. Healing requires you to feel the deep heartache lingering in you, instead of subconsciously recreating the experience so you have an outlet to release it. Healing is no longer trying to sanitize your experience, to cleanse it until it is made perfect. Healing requires you to go through the full expression of every emotion that you cut off and buried when you decided you were no longer comfortable with it. Healing requires you to face every ounce of darkness within you, because just beneath what appears to be an impermeable barrier is complete, radical, total freedom. When you are no longer scared to feel anything, when you no longer resist any one part of your life, something magical happens. You find peace. Let's be clear. You are not going to suffer forever. This is not going to hurt for long. But to trick yourself into thinking that healing is getting progressively better until you have unraveled all of your past experiences and can return to the version of yourself you were before you got hurt, well, that is to miss the point entirely. We are meant to go through these periods of what some refer to as positive disintegration. It is when we must adapt our self-concept to become someone who can handle, if not thrive, in the situation that we are in. This is healthy. This is normal. This is how we are supposed to respond. But we cower because it will be uncomfortable. It will not immediately give us the virtues of what we are taught is a worthwhile life. Comfort and ease and the illusion that everything is perfect on the surface. Healing is not merely what makes us feel better the fastest. It is building the right life slowly and over time. It is greeting ourselves at the reckoning, admitting where we've faltered. It is going back and resolving our mistakes, and going back within ourselves and resolving the anger and fear and small-mindedness that got us there in the first place. Healing is refusing to tolerate the discomfort of change because you refuse to tolerate mediocrity for 1 second longer. The truth is that there is no way to escape discomfort. It finds us wherever we are. But we are either going to feel uneasy, pushing past our self-imposed limits, breaking boundaries, and becoming who we dream of being, or we're going to feel it as we sit and mull over fears we fabricated to justify why we refuse to stand up and begin. Healing is going to be hard at first. It is going to mean looking at yourself honestly, maybe for the first time ever. It is going to mean stepping out of your comfort zone so you can leap toward the person you want to be. It is not what makes you more comfortable and idle. It is what conditions you to be more motivated by discomfort than you are scared of it, and inspired by your still moments more than you use them to forge the chains of worry. Healing is going to change everything, but it has to start with you being willing to feel what you are afraid to feel. Let's be clear about something. Becoming the best version of yourself is your natural inheritance. It is what you are born to do. Healing is simply releasing the sickness that is the limiting beliefs and fears that are holding you back from doing exactly that. Healing is not about going back to exactly who you were before, because that person wasn't yet capable of seeing the storm before it hit, and that person didn't know how to shield themselves from it. You aren't supposed to go back to being naive, less jaded, or more unaware. You aren't meant to return to your blissful mindlessness, a life in which you didn't know about the contrasts, the pain, all of the good and bad that life can throw at you. What you get on the other side of healing is greater than that. You just haven't experienced it yet to know. What you get for going through something painful is that you become more resilient, more self-sufficient, more empowered. You realize that nothing will save you, and so you must begin the work of saving yourself, which is the entire purpose of your life. When you begin this work, you find your inner strength. You realize that you have power and influence, and you can strategize and redirect your life. You realize that instead of what you can't control, your life can be built on what you do. When you heal, you become stronger where you've been broken. You become grounded where you've been egotistical. You become responsible where you've been neglectful. You become more sensitive and able and conscious. You become more considerate. You are more empathetic. You are more mindful, more careful. But what you don't need to be more of is afraid. Fear is not going to protect you. Action is. Worrying is not going to protect you. Preparing is. Overthinking is not going to protect you. Understanding is. When we hold on to fear and pain after something traumatic has passed, we do it as a sort of safety net. We falsely believe that if we constantly remind ourselves of all the terrible things that we didn't see coming, we can avoid them. Not only does this not work, but it also makes you less efficient at responding to them if they do. Because most of the time, you're so busy worrying about monsters in the closet, you forget to address the actual things that will erode you over time. Your health, your relationships, your long-term vision, your finances, your thoughts. When you heal completely, you stop tolerating discomfort. When something is wrong, you recognize that it is wrong and take action to fix it because you've seen what happens when you don't. When you heal completely, you are able to think ahead and rationally consider cause and effect. You recognize that your actions will generate results, and if you want to better control the outcomes of your life, you have to better adjust your habits. When you heal completely, you realize that there is nothing more important than being able to enjoy where you are, right here and right now. Whatever obstructions are in the way of you being present and savoring your life are the challenges you have to face. Because life is quick and it's temporary. What you have now, you could lose tomorrow. And gripping it so tightly, binding it up with resistance, doesn't mean it's safer. It means that when the day comes that it passes, as does everything, as does everyone, you will realize you never really enjoyed it. And healing? It's about getting to a place where you prioritize nothing over the quality of your one short life. Moving forward isn't about getting revenge. Your glow-up might not be something others can see. It might not come across as a shift on the surface. In a world of revenge bodies and comeback relationships, a world that tries to tell you that your ultimate transformation should be splayed out across your Instagram feed, we've lost what it really means to heal, to improve, to move on with our lives. Your glow-up is not learning to draw your eyebrows on perfectly, though that is a perfectly fine thing to want to learn to do. Your glow-up is not wearing tighter clothes, faster fashion, a relationship you can show others to prove that you are finally wanted, though all of those things are empowering and incredible if you choose them. Your transformation is not that you go out with your friends a lot. It is not that you make money now. It is not that you have earned goodness on the surface. This kind of glow-up is empty. That's why it's never enough. The real glow-up isn't proving the people from your past wrong. It is finally feeling so content and hopeful about your future that you stop thinking about them entirely. When you want to change your life so it looks different, and only that, you are still orbiting around the opinions of people who didn't love you and didn't have any intention to. You can always tell the difference, too. People who have truly transformed are not concerned solely with how things appear. Their lives are now focused intently on how things feel, how they really are underneath it all. A real glow-up is authentic. It is lifting off all the cover-up bullshit and addressing the real problems. It is healing. It is changing for good. It is, for the first time, prioritizing your heart over someone else's eyes. Anyone can piece together an image that looks better. Anyone can edit and filter and lay picture after picture side by side to create a narrative, a story, a semblance of the whole. Anyone can buy their way into beauty. Anyone can look nicer if they really try. Anyone can convince you that they are doing better than they really are. If they are so intent on trying to prove that, it is probably because they are still so empty inside. What if you weren't worried about whether or not you look bigger or smaller or nicer or better than you did 10 years ago? What if you were more concerned about whether or not you gained self-respect, real relationships, emotional freedom, mental clarity, a job you appreciate, work you respect, a kinder and more empathetic disposition? What if your accomplishments were not something you could photograph or measure? Nothing you could loosely try to communicate across some pixels and status updates. How are you feeling today? Better than you did yesterday? More whole? More confident? The truth is that there is no before and after in life. We are always in a process of shedding and becoming. That snapshot moment you're waiting for? That instance in which someone dares to look you up again and sees, finally, that you are thriving is a game for you and you alone. Nobody is looking at you the way you think they are. Nobody is thinking about you the way you wish they would. They are looking at themselves. They are thinking about themselves. They are reading themselves. This isn't sad. It's freeing. This should be the crux of your ultimate liberation. The truth is that you have nobody to prove wrong but yourself. The people from your past probably didn't disapprove of you nearly as much as you feared they did. This closure is for you. This growth is for you. This change is yours. This is you versus you, you meeting you, you seeing you for the first time. This is about you becoming who you know you can be. This is about you finally living up to your potential. But mostly, this is about you recognizing that you were not your best self before. You didn't behave the way you wish you would have. You didn't do what you should have. You weren't what you hoped you'd be. Whenever we want desperately to prove someone else wrong, we are really trying to quell our own lingering disappointment that we didn't live up to our own expectations. So remember this. The next time you're trying to craft a glow-up story that is compelling to others, ask yourself why you are still waiting for their approval. The answer, almost always, is that you still do not have your own. Chapter 6, Building a New Future. Now that you have done the challenging work of beginning to release your past experiences, you must turn your attention toward building a new present and future. When we release, we are wiping the slate clean to create something better. One of the most common pitfalls of people who try but do not succeed in releasing their past is that their focus remains on just that, the past. The work now is to envision who you want to be. Connect with the most powerful version of yourself. Design your life through your daily routine and uncover your true purpose for being. Meeting your highest potential future self. A popular tool in psychotherapy is something called inner child work, or the process of imagining and reconnecting with your younger self. In this process, you can offer yourself guidance, even going back to certain traumatizing events and readdressing them with the wisdom you have now. But more often, the process of reconnecting with your inner child is to let them communicate with you. It is how you can rediscover your inherent desires, passions, fears, and feelings. The process is akin to reverse engineering, which is when you identify the end goals for your life and then work backwards to see what you need to do each day, week, month, and year to get there. Step 1. Face the fear first. Sit down in a quiet place with a journal. Make sure you're doing it at a time when you feel relaxed and open to receive guidance. If you go into this with fear, you are going to get fear. Next, close your eyes and begin a meditation session. Take a few moments to breathe deeply and center yourself. Imagine sitting down at a comfortable table in a well-lit room, somewhere that you are happy and feel at peace. Then invite your future self to come sit with you and talk. You can request that they are a certain age, but usually the age will just come to you when you see them. Specifically ask for the highest possible version of yourself to sit down. If you see anything scary at first, know that it is your fear of what could happen manifesting in your mind, not the truth of what will happen. Once you get past that, you can start receiving advice. Step 2. Notice how your future self looks. Aside from what you imagine this version of yourself telling you, pay attention to what they look like, how they behave, and what their facial expressions communicate. The point of doing future self work is so that you can merge with this aspect of yourself. You want to clearly envision the most ideal version of yourself so that you know how your own life needs to grow, shift, and change. See what they wear, how they feel, what they do each day. These will be the keys to your own becoming. Step 3. Ask for guidance. If you go into this process with a laundry list of scary, huge questions for your future self to answer, you're probably going to end up bound by panic rather than being open to receiving powerful guidance. Instead, keep yourself open to whatever this person wants to share with you. The messages should be positive, uplifting, affirming, and helpful. Even if they communicate something to you, such as, "You need to let go of this relationship," it should be done in a way that is so calming and reaffirming that you are confident and at peace with it. Step 4. Imagine them handing you the keys to your new life. Another powerful exercise using your future self is to imagine yourself now, sitting down with yourself 3, 5, or even 7 years ago. It has to be close enough that you can relate to this person, but far enough that you've changed. Imagine sitting down in a space you used to frequent or inhabit. What you're going to do now is hand them the pieces of your current life and all of the information they will need to go from who they are then to who you are now. You can hand them your car keys, your email account for your job, your bank account, an outfit, or instructions on what to do in terms of career, relationships, or just day-to-day habits. Or you can imagine your future self giving you aspects of your life now. Imagine them handing you the keys to the home you live in, or your wedding band, or anything else that is a part of your highest possible future life. Remember, this process should make you feel calm, affirmed, and more self-assured, not the opposite. Fear is a hallucination, a trick of the mind and gut. Your future self can step in and remind you of all that is possible and empower you to live with certainty, clarity, and grace. Releasing your past into the quantum field. When something happens that scares you, and then you do not ever get over that fear, you become traumatized. Trauma is the experience of disconnecting with a fundamental source of safety. It happens most severely when our attachment to our primary caretakers is severed. But there is truly an infinite number of ways the world can traumatize you, and to varying degrees. There are lots of theories about what trauma is and where it comes from. Many believe that it is passed down physically through your DNA. Others argue that it is shared mentally and emotionally through learned patterns and observations. Most commonly, trauma is believed to be an interpersonal experience we have in which we were challenged and then lacked the skills and coping mechanisms to rise to it. Instead, we fell. No matter where it came from, if you have some kind of lingering trauma, you will know because you will feel it. You will feel it physically in your body. You will feel anxiety, tension, fear, terror, sadness, or guilt. It will be displaced. It will not have a clear, direct cause. You will overreact to certain things, and even when a problem is solved, you will still panic. This is the mark of trauma. Trauma is not in your head, it is in your body. This is the first and most important thing you need to know in order to overcome it. Trauma is a legitimate physical issue. You store those emotions, energies, and patterns at a cellular level. Thankfully, we can use the ripples at the top of the water to trace back down to the problem at the bottom, so to say. You can begin to use your body to help you heal. First, identify what caused the traumatic experience. You do this by feeling into yourself and noticing where you are tight or tense. Our bodies harden to protect us. When we have a broken leg, our fascia tightens like a natural cast so that we do not bend ourselves that way again. Similarly, when our hearts are broken, our emotions tighten so that we do not let ourselves feel again. Of course, eventually, we have to walk. We have to love. We have to experience life again. We have to slowly soften the pieces of us that are trying to protect us so that we can move forward. Healing trauma is not just a matter of psychoanalyzing it. It is a matter of literally working through it with your breath. The next time you feel yourself overreacting to some kind of stimulus, you will notice that your body is starting to tense up and create a fight-or-flight response. To heal this, you have to force yourself to take deep, soothing breaths until the part of your body that was once tense is relaxed again. You will need to self-soothe in different ways: meditating, breathing, drinking enough water, getting enough sleep, using aromatherapy, sound therapy, or whatever else works for you. You absolutely must work to take your brain and body physically out of panic survival mode. Second, reinstate a sense of safety. You are traumatized because something scared you, and you are convinced that it is still out to get you. This is what happens when we don't face or overcome something difficult. We assume the threat lingers indefinitely. The psychological aspect of trauma healing is that you have to literally restore the connection that was severed in the exact same way that it was broken. If you are traumatized about relationships, you need to build healthy relationships. If you are traumatized about money, you need to get really good with money. If you are traumatized about traveling, you need to travel again. We do not find the resolution in avoiding these things forever. In fact, just underneath the fear, we often find that they are the things we really want more than anything else. Third, stop taking thoughts and feelings at face value. Last, to overcome trauma, you have to stop engaging in psychic thinking. You have to stop pretending you are able to predict what will happen, that you know other people's intentions, or that what you feel and think is absolute truth and reality. This kind of thinking is what takes a triggering feeling and turns it into a defeating spiral. You take one scary thing and make it into a prediction for what the future will hold. You are not an oracle. You do not know what's next, though you are always capable of choosing what you do now. Almost always, the thing you are most panicked about is a thing you do not know is happening for sure. It is usually an assumption, a projection, a fear turned into a terrifying potential reality. You might think that trauma is something that other, more damaged people have, but that is not true. Everyone is traumatized in one way or another, but it is how we respond to it, how we ultimately grow and develop self-mastery from it, that determines the course of our lives. Becoming the most powerful version of yourself. Are you being the most powerful version of yourself? If you had to pause to think about it, the answer is probably no. Everybody has different facets of their personality, and we act on them based on the context we're in. It's a social adaptation tool. You are not the same person with your friends as you are with your parents. Moving through these easily is a sign of high psychological function. We are acquainted with the versions of ourselves that our current life requires. We know who we need to be at work, at home, or in love. But we are often unfamiliar with the person we need to be in order to move our lives forward. In inner child work, you visualize and address your younger selves, often down to a specific age, depending on which version of you was traumatized. You communicate with that inner child self, learn from them, protect them, or give them the guidance that they needed when they were young. This proves to be profoundly healing for people, mostly because we do not evolve past our former selves, we simply grow upon them. However, this practice can work the opposite way as well. You can also visualize and connect with your future self, the version of you that you are growing into, or the person you know you are meant to be. What would my most powerful self do today? The first step to becoming your most powerful self is to literally envision that person. Don't take yourself out of your current context either. Begin to ask yourself, what would the most powerful version of me do right now? What would they do with this day? How would they respond to this challenge? How would they move forward? How would they think? What would they feel? Your most powerful self needs to be the CEO of your life. It is the person making managerial decisions, governing everything else. This is the editor-in-chief, the matriarch or patriarch. You are working for your most powerful self. Once you have a clearer image of what your most powerful self is like, you then need to evaluate what habits, traits, and behaviors are actively holding you back from fully embodying that person. Be aware of your weaknesses. Powerful people are not delusional. They do not believe they are perfect all the time at everything. This is not what makes them mentally strong. Instead, powerful people are very aware of their varying strengths and weaknesses. In business, powerful people will often outsource the tasks at which they are less skilled. In life, powerful people know where their limits are and what their triggers might be. This allows them to move through their lives with more ease and to give themselves the time and space needed to work on their faults. The ability to say to yourself, "I know I struggle a lot with this, so I'm going to take my time and work on it," is one of the most powerful things you can do. Be willing to be disliked. Powerful people are not the ones who are most universally liked. They are also not the ones vying for others' approval, and that's the key. To be a truly powerful person, you must be willing to be disliked. This is not to say that you behave in any way that's malicious, but it is to say that no matter what you do, others are going to judge you. Powerful people know this. There is no path in life that you can take that will be free of resistance from others. And so it is important that you not only become okay with being disliked, but you anticipate it and act anyway. Act on purpose. Powerful and purposeful are one and the same. To be a truly powerful person, you need to have complete, unwavering conviction about what you want to create. To do this, you have to shift from a live for the moment to a live for the legacy mindset. Your purpose is a dynamic, evolving thing. Most of the time, it is at the intersection of what you are interested in, what you are good at, and what the world needs. Having a clear vision of what you want to create and accomplish is essential to finding your inner power. You will not feel strongly about a dream that is not part of who you most essentially are. Do your inner work. This is perhaps the most important and yet most commonly overlooked because it is the least comfortable. To do your inner work means to evaluate why something triggered you, why something is upsetting you, what your life is trying to show you, and the ways you could grow from these experiences. Truly powerful people absorb what has happened to them and sort of metabolize it. They use it as an opportunity to learn, to develop themselves. This type of inner mental and emotional work is non-negotiable if you want to be truly powerful. Powerful people are not the most aggressive. Aggression is usually a self-defense mechanism. Powerful people are the ones most unfazed by small disturbances and most willing to fully process and work through the big ones. Of course, this is the foundational stuff. Next, you have to work on simplifying your life, talking less about your ambitions, and showing more of your accomplishments once they are completed. Gradually make health improvements. Assume that everyone and everything has something to teach you. Become comfortable with vulnerability. As vulnerability precedes almost every significant part of your life, and intentionally design your daily routine. Through everything, you must be thinking as your most powerful self would. If you learn to see the world and your life through that lens, you can create a life that reflects the intentions of that side of you. It already exists. You just need to know how to tap into it. Learning to validate your feelings. If we want to be effective in therapy, in politics, in relationships, in teaching kids, in talking someone down from the edge, in keeping peace, making friends, fostering connection, and making progress, there's one technique we have to employ first. It's a little secret, and it's one that requires very little effort, but it disarms people. It opens them, makes them receptive, willing to listen, and adapt. It is healing. It is mind-altering. But most importantly, it is the first step to progress. It is emotional validation. Validating someone's feelings doesn't mean you agree with them. It doesn't mean you concede that they are correct. It doesn't mean that those feelings are the healthiest. It doesn't mean they are informed by logic. Validating feelings does not mean you make them more true. It means you remind someone that it is human to feel things they don't always understand. How often do we just need a partner to stop trying to strategize and just say, "That must really suck"? How much of a weight is lifted off our shoulders when we think, "Yes, I really am stressed right now, and I deserve to be"? How light do we feel when we see another person's story splayed out across a screen, one that we can relate to and understand, no matter how devastating it is? How much better do we feel when we simply allow ourselves to be aggrieved and pissed off and irrationally mad? When we let ourselves have it, the feeling that is, something incredible happens. We no longer have to take it out on other people, because we are no longer relying on their validation to get us through it. We can be aggrieved and pissed and mad and do our own processing without hurting anyone else. When people are crying out or acting out in their lives. They aren't just asking for help. They are most often just asking for someone to affirm that it is okay to feel the way that they do. And if they have to inflate and exaggerate circumstances for you to truly feel the weight and impact that they do, they'll do it. They'll do whatever it takes to get someone else to say, "I am so sorry for what you are going through." This is not because they are incompetent or dumb. It is because in a world that does not teach us how to adequately process our own feelings, we must often rely solely on our maladaptive coping mechanisms. When we cannot validate our own feelings, we go on a never-ending quest to try to force others to do it for us, but it never works. We never really get what we need. This looks like needing attention, affirmation, compliments, but it also looks like being dramatic, negative, and focusing disproportionately on what's wrong in our lives. When someone is complaining about something simple, and they seem to be doing it more than the given situation would call for, they aren't trying to get your help about a small issue. They are trying to have their feelings validated. This is also a common root of self-sabotaging behaviors. Sometimes, when we have deep wells of grief within us, we absolutely cannot allow ourselves to relax and enjoy our lives and relationships. We cannot just have fun, because doing so feels like a betrayal. It feels offensive. We need to feel validated, but we don't even know why. Why is this effective? Think of your feelings like water running through ducts in your body. Your thoughts determine whether or not the ducts are clean. The cleanliness of the ducts determines the quality of the water. If you suddenly have a feeling that you dislike and don't expect, a sudden rush of water, let's say, it's common to want to shut that valve off and not allow it to pass. However, stopping the flow of water does not make the water go away. Instead, it begins to intensely pressurize and create serious damage to the parts of your body that are no longer receiving flow. This begins to have a ripple effect on your entire life. Sometimes the water disperses itself gradually. Other times it implodes and creates what we see on the surface as a complete emotional breakdown. When all of that water finally comes through and we grieve and cry and fall apart, we are going through a process of being reset. It is positive disintegration. We are gutted. We are cleaned. We feel calm, refreshed, and relieved. All that happened in that implosion was that your feelings became validated when you gave yourself permission to feel them because you had no other choice. This is what we do in therapy. This is what we do when we vent. This is what happens when we experience a catharsis. A sad movie that we kind of enjoy being sad about allows us to feel sad in a world that otherwise does not. But there's a healthier, easier way, which is learning how to process our feelings in real time. Validating your feelings sounds like a big term, but it really means one thing. It's just letting yourself have them. When you are healing past trauma, often a big component is allowing yourself to experience the full expression of an emotion. You have probably done this healthily and correctly in the past. Think about the passing of a relative whom you loved but were not overly attached to. When you learned of their death, you were undoubtedly sad, but you didn't attend their funeral, cry for an hour, and then carry on with your life as though nothing happened. Instead, you probably experienced a bout of sadness then, and then maybe the next day, and then maybe a week later. The waves of grief came and went in varying intensity. When you didn't resist them, you cried and felt sad, or maybe took a nap, a hot bath, or a day off from work. And then, without much effort from you, the feeling passed, and you felt better. Once we have and acknowledge an emotion, it will often go away on its own. If there is no course of action to take, if all we really need to do is accept it, then we just have to let ourselves be there. Feelings, once felt, begin to change themselves over time. The reason we don't do this more naturally is because obviously we can't burst into tears at our desks every time we feel bothered by something. But turning off the water valve is perfectly fine, as long as we can go home and let it out later. It is okay to control when and where we process, and in fact, it's better when we learn to do it in a more stable, safe space. This can look like taking a few minutes to junk journal each day, spending time by ourselves where we can simply experience how we feel without judgment and without trying to change them. It can be as simple as allowing ourselves to cry before we fall asleep. We often think of that as a sign of weakness, when really, the ability to cry freely is a huge signal of mental and emotional strength. It's when we can't cry about what's truly broken in our lives that we have a big problem. Validating the way someone else feels is an exercise in radial empathy. It is starting the conversation with, "It is okay to feel this way." Because when we point out how wrong someone is to feel the way they do, they shut down. And they shut down because they feel shame. They already know it's not right to feel the way they do. If you start the conversation by heightening someone's defenses or making them panic and suppress even harder, you make the situation worse. But if you start with reminding them that anyone in their situation would probably feel similar to how they do right now, and that it is very possible that they can have strong, overwhelming emotions that don't necessarily mean their lives are completely ruined, and that it is okay to feel devastated when devastating things are before us, we lighten their load. We know this because when we stop resisting feeling sad and just let ourselves be sad, we realize that it will not last forever. We see that sometimes the biggest problem isn't that we are devastated, but that in refusing to accept what is in front of us, we create so much more suffering than we would if we had just had a cry when we needed to have a really good cry. Validating other people teaches us how to validate ourselves. And when we learn how to validate ourselves, we become stronger. We see that our emotions are no longer threats, but informants. They show us what we care about, what we want to savor, and what we want to protect. They remind us that life is fleeting and challenging and gorgeous. When we are willing to accept the darkness, it is only then that we find the light. Adopting your own principles. If you feel lost, or as though you don't know where you want your life to go next, or worse, fear that everything you have built could come crashing down, you don't need more inspiration. You don't need more positive thinking. You do not need more Pinterest photos or inspirational quotes. When you have money problems, you need money principles. When you have relationship problems, you need relationship principles. When you have work problems, you need work principles. When you have life problems, you need life principles. More money does not solve money problems. Different relationships do not solve relationships.